Now I'd like to introduce Alex to you. Alex is a postgraduate medical trainee in psychiatry at the University of Lorraine in France. He's flown all the way over for this weekend, so we're very honoured to have him here. He also studies public health at graduate level at the University of Liverpool. His dissertation is a qualitative study that explores stigma in psychiatry from the perspective of family members of individuals with schizophrenia. He's also studying philosophy at Birkbeck, which I know some others of you have done here, and he's interested in metaphysics, philosophy of mind, and political philosophy, among others. And the title of his talk is Metaphysics and Morality in Mental Health, and there were handouts at the back which you should all have.
Yes, thank you.
Do we need the handouts
to understand? Yes, some parts, yeah. So maybe yes.
How many sheets are there?
40.
How many sheets should we each take? It starts by identity.
The last page is the one with the references.
The first line
of the first page is identity. Second page, in order to answer. Kant disagrees, right? Schizophrenia. The self is a fiction. Social, not a solipsistic endeavor. Morality and mental health. Existence. Sophists and psychiatrists. Okay.
Learning more. Number of pages.
Should I use this for? Oh, great. Perfect.
I think I used the reference on the back of the last page.
40 times 12 pages, I'm ready. So, I'll start, even though I got an introduction, I'm happy to say that I'm not that person. Philosophy major has to find work in ancient Greece. But I'm passionate about philosophy. And I chose a job. I'm a postgraduate trainee in psychiatry, and I didn't know it, but there are a lot of philosophical issues in psychiatry that are really important. And my initial idea was to present to you a variety of topics that I find in my everyday clinical practice that are philosophical. But in the end, when I started working on that, I realized that I need 45 days and not minutes to talk about all these things. So I picked two of them, identity and morality. And I'm sure you're going to like the morality part because you're interested in the criminality. So, I'm going to talk about identity, and I'm going to use the cases of two people, Mary and Irvin. Mary has dissociative identity disorder, and Irvin has schizophrenia. And their story, well, it's not really a story, but their case will help me to talk about some issues about identity. Identity is a huge topic, There are a lot of different questions, but we're just going to talk about some of them today. And then we're going to talk about morality and its link to mental health. And so we're going to talk about Plato and the soul. So, identity. Mary was a quiet 30-year-old woman who was meek and reticent and had many avoidant traits.
She was people here, Alex, because you might use the...
Right. Or should I speak maybe... Because I'm not going to sit down. So she was talking about some of the events of her past, which included several severe sexual abuse starting at the age of 20 months. She began to tell the psychiatrist about a crying voice she heard constantly. Baby cries all the time. Baby, I hear her. She's sad all the time. She can't talk, but she cries all the time. She's a wimp. I would never put up with any of that. I'll kill him. I'll kill him. I'll kill you too, and she deserves to die. The psychiatrist. Who, baby? Mary, she's a wimp. What about baby? What are you talking about? May I speak to Mary? She doesn't have the guts to come here. So that's a clinical case report, actually, that I picked up from the literature, medical literature. And it shows that Mary suffers from dissociative identity disorder. So previously that was called a multiple personality disorder. And actually, dissociation is something that we all do every day. Daydreaming, you know, at some points we're focusing on something and we forget ourselves, so it's perfectly normal. But in these cases, the patients switch off and they're not conscious anymore, but somebody else is there, as is the case of Mary and Edith. So this severe disorder will help us to answer, or at least reflect upon, some very interesting questions. And one of the first questions I think is interesting here is, how many are there? Is Mary one person? Are there two people, Mary and Edith? So Leibniz... I will use Leibniz's principle of individuation to start the discussion. So he says that no distinct two things exactly resemble each other, otherwise they would be indiscernibles, and therefore one thing. So he argues that knowing individuals necessitates their singularization, which means their enumeration of their characteristics. So the numerical self is a person's identity, according to Leibniz, in a specific point of time, so the synchron, and over time, so the diachron, or transtemporal. Well, the problem with that is that, for instance, I, today, would count as a person, Alex, and in 10 years, maybe I will have different political views, for instance. So I will have a different sum of characteristics. And according to Leibniz, I would be a different person. But this doesn't really seem right, does it? So Locke adds the memory criterion. So he says that an individual with memories about her previous states of consciousness maintains her numerical identity. This means that it's the same person. So if I have memories of myself from 10 years before, for instance, 10 years before and today, I'm the same person. This is the memory principle of Locke. But according to Locke, a person is a thinking, intelligent being that has a reason, reflection, and consciousness. And that's quite problematic, because with people with dementia, for instance, who have lost a great deal of their mental capacities, like memory, according to Locke, they wouldn't be considered as individuals, as persons. So memory is not sufficient to talk about identity. So according to Leibniz and Locke, Mary and Edith are numerically two different people, Because, A, they're not indiscernible, and B, Mary does not have Edith's memories, and vice versa. That's quite strange, isn't it? To say that there are two people inside one body. So, Kant doesn't really agree with all this approach, and he says that it's all right to try to pick up one element, or maybe two, or several elements of a person in order to say that this is what identity is. But this will only help us to answer the epistemological question of what identity is. And Kant doesn't really believe that this is the real question. For him, what's more important is the ontological question. What am I? So, he argues that the self is transcendental, and identity is only part of it. The thing that transcends the person and persists in time and space, and even goes beyond it, is an immaterial substance, the soul. So this is what Kant says. And this has its tradition in idealism. So Descartes and Kant share a dualistic notion of the self. This means that people have matter and mind. And the idea actually comes from ancient times and medieval times, and it corresponds to the notion of the soul. So, the thing is that the problem with that view, empiricists say, Locke for instance, so how do you explain that Mary has two different people, let's say, inside of her, if she's a unified soul? It makes no sense, it's illogical to say that. Other philosophers, however, Hacking, whom you will find in your references, argues that actually DID, so dissociative identity disorder, presupposes that you do have a unified soul for you to be having this disorder. And he actually calls DID AID, associative identity disorder, in order to show that the person actually tries to regain access to this unified soul by this way of being. Well, the argument can go both ways, so it's not really satisfactory. So overall, the empiricist argument against this Cartesian way of viewing identity, so this transcendental soul, is quite interesting because it has practical implications. For instance, Edith might actually kill somebody without Mary knowing it, without her being conscious about it, and without her even having a memory about it. And this is actually, there have been a lot of cases where people with DID have committed crimes, murders, but they were not conscious of that at that time. And this is very important because it raises a very fundamental question about moral responsibility. Who committed the crime? So, the next question about identity is, who am I? So, what is the thing that makes me who I am? And what would it take for me to be somebody else? And schizophrenia is a very interesting disease because it shows exactly that people lose their capacity to have what we call personhood. So Erwin is a young man of 23 years old, and he's been recently diagnosed with schizophrenia. And even though the symptoms, what we call the positive symptoms, so the delusion and the hallucinations and all these things are gone with his medication, what is there is the emptiness that Erwin feels. He has no life plans, he has no memories, he cannot project himself into the future, and he even told his psychiatrist, that's me, I do not know who I am. And that's very bizarre, because to us all these things are very, we automatically think that, well, I have this hobby, and I want to do that next year, and I want to finish my philosophy degree, and all these things. But Erwin cannot do that. So schizophrenia is a severe and enigmatic psychiatric disorder, for the ones who do not really know what it is, in which perception, thought, and affect are severely disturbed. There's a certain oddity and remoteness that patients describe because they do not really sense themselves. Their self-awareness is disturbed. They have a loss of feeling of unity and a loss of this feeling of ownership over their own actions. So who am I? This is a question I think that everybody asks themselves at some point in their lives. And there are actually two ways the literature deals with that in philosophy. There is the self-asphyxian, which is a more Anglo-American approach to identity, and the hermeneutic self, which is a more continental philosophy approach to identity. So we're going to take a look at both of these. So, the self-asphyxian. So the logico-analytic approach tries to identify criteria that are sufficient and necessary for a person to be a person. So there have been many different theories. For instance, that identity is in the brain, that identity is in the body, in the memory, in psychological connectedness. And all of these things are a reductionist approach to saying where identity is. So it's a rather third-person perspective to giving an answer to this question. On the other hand, the continental philosophical approach is more phenomenological. It takes a first-person approach. So this means it tries to analyze the experience of the person. So you have Husserl, Heidegger, and Merleau-Ponty. And they see identity as a narrative which is inscribed in the cultural, historical, political web of a person's community. The self-asphyxian is the logico-analytic approach. It starts with Hume, who says that the I, when I try to reflect who I am, the thing that I actually think about are my perceptions. So for Hume, the only thing there is perception. And the I is just a fiction to explain the perceptions that I receive. So Dennett, for instance, is a contemporary philosopher who provides arguments for the self as fiction. So for him, there is no self, but multiple parallel mental processes, only few of which survive and become conscious. And the self is a locus that we posit to organize and to give sense to this sensory perception. In this sense, identity equals brain function. For Dennett, clearly, identity is brain function. And the narrator, so I, come out of the narrative and not the other way around. It's like saying that the book writes itself and there is no author writing the book. I read, actually, a month ago, Raymond Tallis' Dictionary of Pseudo-Neuropsychology. It's very interesting. And he talks about empathetic transfer. And he says, when we talk about human beings, for instance, and we say that human beings are conscious, we tend in cognitive science to say that neurons are conscious, or neurons computate, for instance, or that the brain calculates and is conscious. So it doesn't really make sense, according to Raymond Tallis, to say that a neuron or the brain has the properties that a human being has.
If there are a typo here, then it shouldn't be mental processes as being conscious, it's neural processes.
Right, yes, yeah, exactly. True, yes, yes. Yeah. Neural processes.
So cross out mental and put neural.
Neural, right.
Neural.
Neural. So, within this approach, the reductionist approach to identifying identity, in Western philosophy, identity tends to be considered equal to psychological continuity. This means that memory is, for Western philosophers generally, the necessary and sufficient criterion for identity. But, as we've seen before, there is a problem with that, because there is no there is a lack of memory continuity, meaning that even though I am today the person that I was 10 years ago, and I am the person that I will be in 20 years, for instance, based on the identity continuity, memory doesn't really work like that, because in 20 years I may not be remembering what happened 10 years ago from today. Well, one of the solutions to that problem is that you might replace or add to direct memory indirect memory. So you might say that in 20 years I will not be remembering what happened 30 years ago, but today I do remember what happened 10 years ago. So in the future I will be the same person because today I do remember what happened 10 years ago. Well, it's just a way of dealing with a problem which I do not really think is very important in this discussion. Another problem is, however, that there are instances in our everyday lives, for example, sleeping, where I'm not conscious at all. And the question is there, how do I explain that I am the same person when I'm not really conscious? Well, one way to deal with this problem is to talk about causal dependence, which means that 20 years from now, I will be the same person because my psychological state today caused me to become the person in 20 years. And likewise, my unconscious state when I'm sleeping causes me to be the person that I'm today. Well, you may disagree or agree with that. It's not very important. It's just to show that the reductionist approach is quite interesting, but it has its problems. On the other hand, continental philosophy and, for example, psychoanalysis in the hermeneutic tradition considers there to be actually a real self that subtends the narrative it tells. So there is an author, actually, who writes a book. They argue that it is absurd to think that books write themselves, right? And you need a person who will write the book, and not vice versa. Wittgenstein, for instance, doesn't believe that there is any essential substance to identity. He believes that there is no one thing that can tell us what identity is. It's not the brain, it's not memory, it's not psychological continuity, none of that can explain globally and holistically what identity is. He gives the games analogy, and he just cites different board games, and he cites different characteristics of these board games, and he says that there are different characteristics, but there is not one all-englobing characteristic, fundamental essence to all these board games that can explain what a board game is. Well, that's the analogy for identity. He thinks that any neuroscientific approach to solving the question, what is identity, will fail because there is not one thing that can explain what identity is. Then I cite different other philosophers, for example, Flanagan, who talks about the writing book again, metaphor, and Taylor, who thinks that apart from the making plans about the future, there is a need in society for you to have an identity because of your moral responsibility and accountability. In society, you need to say, Alex did that, and Marianne did that, for instance. So Marianne and Alex need to have an identity for us to identify those people and their actions. So, as I told you before, identity is very has a lot of different questions. I just try to give you an overview of some of the questions that I encounter within my clinical practice, because I think that's the interesting thing, to see how psychiatry, for instance, and philosophy communicate and meet each other. Right. So, the second part of today's presentation is about morality. And I find it quite fascinating, to be honest with you, because we all think that morality is one thing and mental health is another thing. But actually, there is a relationship between them, or there are people who believe that there is a relationship between them. And I'm giving you some examples here in the first page that reads morality and mental health on the top. Of some concepts and issues that were previously seen under the light of morality, and today we've medicalized them. and maybe it's a bit exaggerated, but the essence is there. Possession by evil spirits, for instance, is today conversion disorder or hysteria. Pride is narcissism. Cowardice is avoidant personality disorder, and so on and so on. But can everything be seen under the light of medicine and thus treated by medical treatment, or are some things irrelevant to medicine and just a matter of morality, or other things that are both? So Plato gave the foundations upon which the concept of mental health was created. In Crito, he talks to us about the analogy of the body and the soul. So he says that bodies on the one hand are improved by health and injured by disease. So the same thing happens to the soul. The soul is improved by right conduct and injured by wrong conduct. So to Plato, everything has a function, and he calls that ergon. The soul has the function to rule, to manage, and to deliberate. How the soul is going to go about to do this function is another question. For Plato, the virtue, so the arete in ancient Greek, of the soul is to perform these functions in a just way. Morality is therefore, for Plato, the foundation for virtuous function. A person who functions well is a person who is virtuous, simply said. And immorality is the opposite. So for Plato, actually, a person who is immoral is actually unhealthy. And that's quite interesting, I think. There are three parts in the soul, according to Plato. So there's the appetite at the bottom, so drinking, eating, having sex, and all these things. The spirit, the pleasure, the anger, so the emotion, for instance. And, on top, reason, which is there to control things. Well, there is an analogy with Freud, and of course Freud was influenced by Plato and also Spinoza later. So for Plato, what's important here to know is that the parts of the soul aren't equal. Reason is the most important thing and commands all other parts. And this is important because for Plato, this means that the soul's goal is self-mastery. He thinks that a person must ensure that each part fulfills its appointed function without encroaching on the others. So health, for Plato, is a balance between the part of the soul. So according to nature, kataphysin in ancient Greece. And an imbalance of the function of each of these parts is disease. So paraphysin, contrary to nature. Of course, for Plato, it's not only about the individual, but also about society, because he extrapolates that to society, saying that in democracy, for instance, which is an unhealthy situation for Plato, this is exactly what's happening. The passion is much greater than the reason. And if we think about the individual, we can think about it in the same way. This way, he tries to attack a common idea back in the 5th century before Christ. Because back then, they thought that by nature, human beings are aggressive and hostile. And morality is just a product of convention in order to tame that. So morality isn't something that comes naturally to people, according to that idea, but it's taught to people because of society. Plato, however, doesn't agree with that. He thinks that the natural way of being is being moral and being just. And he thinks that the fact that we are hostile and aggressive, for instance, is the result of a disease, immorality. What we need to bear in mind here is that back then, nature wasn't mechanistic. Well, we didn't think about nature as mechanistic. As we do today. Nature was teleological, meaning that it had a purpose. So the purpose was balance, for instance, and whenever a person would have more passion, for instance, than reason, nature, so it had a either a deficiency or something more than needed, nature would do the needed thing to correct this imbalance. And he thinks that doctors, for instance, are there to assist nature in bringing back the harmony of the soul. So what kind of treatment does he actually suggest? Of course, philosophy. I mean, this is, of course, the only treatment necessary for for people. And the reason for that is that he wants to create aporia, meaning the sense of not knowing, of ignorance, so the people can be freed of prejudices and of self of the spirit of conceit. So, I'm not sure if we can actually say that schizophrenia, for instance, or dementia are the result of immorality. I do not think so at all. But I think that this conceptualization of Plato is rather interesting in concerning other character traits, for instance, as we talked about before, cowardice or pride and all these things. And, of course, criminals, because I think you're interested in that, Fozzie, aren't you? You believe that they shouldn't be seen as merely as criminals, but they should be treated about that. And Plato thinks the same thing. And I think that's a very interesting and different approach than that we have today, meaning prison and nothing else. So, the last thing I've written on the last page is something that I think is very interesting for mental health practitioners everywhere. Psychiatrists, nurses, psychologists, everyone. It's Carl Jaspers who said that the psychiatrist's competence is commensurate with how far his education and knowledge would qualify him to belong to the philosophic faculty. And I think that's very interesting, because indeed the many, many things in psychiatry that are relevant to philosophy, or maybe vice versa, there are many philosophical things relevant to psychiatry. And I think that a person, a mental health professional who is who knows these things can discuss them in a different way and can maybe even take different approaches with the patients. So that's it.
Thank you very much, Alex, for a very interesting and stimulating discussion. So we have a few minutes now for some question time. So perhaps you might need a few moments just to bring your thoughts together. And we have one already from Brendan.
Alex, I think very well spoken and very well said, and I congratulate you on your expertise in that matter. You mentioned identity.
Mm-hmm.
You asked the question, can I know that my identity today is the same as it was 10 years ago, or perhaps will be 30 years from now? You're asking this general question.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that you had an identity that you have today, 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
or that you have the identity you have today, 30 years mm-hmm. from now?
Mm-hmm.
Or, to put it another way, what's this identity thing?
I didn't give you any answers. I just give you two directions, two possible directions to answer that question. So I might take the reductionist approach and tell you, well, I have memories of who I was 10 years ago, and memory is a sufficient and necessary condition for me to be the same person as I was 10 years ago, and the same goes for the future. Or I might tell you, I might take a idealistic and Cartesian Kantian approach and tell you, well, I have a unified soul and it will even be there when I'm dead. Mm. I do not have an answer, of course. And the Locke wouldn't think, for instance, that I had an identity when I was an embryo, or if I am in a vegetative state, because I do not think, I do not reason, therefore I'm not a person. So I do not really have an answer, but I think that it's interesting to take different approaches to that answer.
And just a little supplementary,
mm-hmm.
someone who has dementia, mm-hmm. short-term memory loss, can't remember things that happened 3 days ago, but can remember something that happened 20 years ago. Is their sense of identity the same?
What do you think?
Well, I would question the word identity. That being me, I would say that it's just a convention. Mm-hmm. It's a word which can mislead, if we can go down the wrong track and give us a lot of mental cramp. Mm-hmm.
You may say that memory, for instance, is not per se sufficient and necessary for identity, and maybe there is something more specific to memory, so autobiographical memory, because that's what you're saying, and not task memory, for instance, because when I remember that I put this here, this is not autobiographical, this is task-related memory, but the fact that I remember that I lived in Munich and then I moved to Greece, for instance, that's autobiographical, and you may say that this is the kind of memory that you want for identity. I don't know, it's just, you know, on the top of my head.
Very good.
I need.
Well, that was such an interesting talk. I don't really know where to stop. You seem to be talking mainly about personal identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when philosophers of mind worry about this, I think they maybe, I don't know if they solve it, but there seem to be two views. One is that it's the person that you consider, and this seems to be the view that you're taking. And the other is that you know that you're the same thing because you've got a biological continuity. You're the same body.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got two separate notions there. And then going, all right, go on.
Actually, as I told you, there are many different questions about identity. So what you're saying is, what am I? Am I a biological organism? Am I a soul? Am I a part of the brain, an extension of the brain? Am I an extension of memory? So from what I understood reading the articles to write that, there is no answer to that, of course. And to be quite honest, I was also very confused when I read, because self, identity, personal identity, all these terms are used interchangeably, especially by medical writers who write about philosophy, and it's just, there is no conceptual clarity there, and I think that there's a lot of work to do in order to, you know, clarify these things, of course. Yeah.
Right.
So I don't really know.
Yeah, and I think Leibniz was just interested, as far as I don't know what you've read that I don't know about, but he was only interested in what makes it the case that object A equals object B,
right,
and are they one and the same thing?
Right.
And you've got the identity of indiscernibles and the indiscernibility. So if object A equals object B, then they must have all of their properties
exactly
in common,
yeah,
which is sort of common sense. And then the other way around, if you get two objects that have all of their properties in common, mm-hmm, then they've got to be the same thing. Mm-hmm. But then the question arises, do you count spatio-temporal location including the properties? Now, Leibniz wouldn't, but most of us would.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Leibniz really helps with this, because the questions you've been discussing are not really what makes the same thing as B, because then you've got to think what kind of a thing it is, and what kind of persistence conditions it's got, and that's different. That's
it's
separate.
Too general. It's
yeah,
very,
yeah, yeah.
It's a very specific
yeah
case
yeah,
when
well
you talk about personal identity.
It's a thing you need to consider, but you're talking about the persistence conditions of a person.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right, we'll just take one question at the moment, which is Chris's, and then there'll be a panel of question time later on, so you can ask your questions there.
Okay,
so
you say at the head of your section on morality and mental health,
mm-hmm,
the medicalisation of a lot of terms that were normally considered under morality.
Right.
Does this open up the possibility of denying moral responsibility? For instance, could you now argue, this is my makeup, this is the way I am, therefore I am not responsible for this murder, or I am not responsible for this theft, because I have kleptomania? So this worries me to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually,
one more point. People now also make this same argument for it's genetically my makeup, mm-hmm, for certain things, therefore I am not responsible for my actions.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't take a physicalist approach to that. I mean, I definitely think that, I just remembered Spinoza, for instance, who talks about the fact that you can have both the physical way of understanding things and the mental way of understanding things, and they go together in a parallel way. So I do not think that the argument it's my genetics that make me who I am is really a good argument for that. But when I said that, it wasn't really to say that people would be able to say it's not my responsibility. It's actually clarifying this even more, because when you have somebody who has DID, for instance, and really commits a murder when they're not themselves, it's a really tough question. Who are you going to hold? Who is accountable for that? So it wasn't in that direction where anyone could do anything and say, well, it's just the way I am. It was more for the things that we do not really have an answer to. For example, DID. Yeah. I agree with you that it doesn't apply to everyone. Of course not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, well, can we give a warm round of applause?